If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to the middle of nowhere. We are about as remote as we possibly could be to be recording a podcast.
Yeah, is this going to be one of the off-road podcasts? What's the plan?
I think that's the plan, yeah. I want to talk about our adventure. I want to talk about some of the stuff we've been chatting about on this three-day adventure. So some background. We're like, I don't know, 40 miles outside of Moab, Utah.
Yeah, we probably spent 3 hours or so driving, kind of meandering, not necessarily taking the most direct and fastest path to where we are now. But it's pretty cool because at the moment it's very busy in Moab. It's kind of the beginning of peak season, so it's good weather there. There's tons of people. Where we are, it's dead quiet.
Yeah, so we're along something called the Kokopelli Trail, which is typically a bike route that connects Grand Junction to Moab. It's actually pretty long. I think it's 100, 140 miles. We're doing a stretch of it in our four-wheel drives, and we thought it'd be cool to bring out two cars from the same era.
Yeah, so yours is a 2006. I'm driving a 2005. What you're in is your Land Rover LR3, one that you got for $4,500, did some upgrades to it, almost no repairs other than regular maintenance, a fluid change on the transmission, and anything else?
That's it.
Major? Yeah.
Yeah, so that's it. Yeah, I mean, I've put a little bit of like, all right, I need your opinion. Is this considered a fault of the vehicle or regular maintenance? So I had to do lower control arms and a drive shaft. But it's also 20 years old.
Yeah.
Right?
Wasn't that the drive shaft was flying apart. There's kind of a carrier bearing of sorts with a bushing in it, right?
Yeah.
And the bushing was getting old. So it's really just rubber parts aging out. I don't really think that that's necessarily a
failure.
A failure, yeah.
Yeah, not a breakdown. So I mean, like, I could have kept going with my clunky lower front control arms and the drive shaft, but basically we agreed to do this thing with our sponsor Onyx, where we'd spend 3 days, two nights out on what they call a rugged adventure. And look, a lot has been done around Moab, Utah. You've got all the famous trails, Hell's Revenge, Fins and Things, Poison Spider. I mean, we could have done any number of those, but what I thought would be cool is the fun way in and out of Moab. So if you're kind of passing through, or you want to like do like a quick greatest hits of Moab over a really short period, this is a cool way to do it.
Yeah, so we're a little off the beaten path. There's plenty of trails that we've filmed several times and trails that a lot of people have run over and over again. But I think the cool thing about what we're doing on this is it's a little something different. Probably a stretch of trail systems that most people haven't had a chance to check out.
And I'll include a link in the full video, which is going to go up very shortly, but I've created this route, and I think it's going pretty well. But basically, if you're going down I-70, either east or west, you go south toward Moab, and you could just take, it's called, I think it's the Highways 191. You could take that all the way down into Moab, Utah. But what I thought would be cool is to actually stop and visit Arches, but go through the back way.
Yeah.
So off of the main highway, we turned left just 4 miles from Interstate 70. And then we took this beautiful dirt trail into the backside of Arches. You avoid all the traffic, all the madness of trying to get into the national park. And then we also found some cool little off-road trails to explore out there.
Yeah, some pretty interesting stuff. It's surprisingly damp out here right now.
Yeah.
So we've actually come across some mud, which is fun because especially being based in Colorado, we don't usually get to spend that much time in mud.
Yeah, for sure.
So
no, it's been awesome.
Yeah, a little something different from the usual slick rock, silt, and dirt that we find ourselves on all the time.
Like, we've hit on this in a very short amount of time. We've hit slick rock, obviously. We hit some sand, obviously gravel, a tarmac, of course, and then some genuinely pretty slick trails.
Yeah.
Because what happened was, is April's a little bit unpredictable. You know, there is some like sporadic rain, but it doesn't hit everywhere. It just hits in spots. And it can turn a level 2 trail into like a level 4, even potentially 5 in spots. But anyway, we started in Arches National Park. Then we spent the night in Moab, drove through much of the park, actually got to see some cool sights. And then this morning we woke up and, continuing with that greatest hits thing, we did our, you know, most common trail that we experience out here in Utah.
Yeah, so we did Fins and Things.
Yep.
Which is kind of a staple for us, and I think it's a really good trail to test a lot of vehicles, especially vehicles that are either stock or nearly stock.
Yeah.
And both of these machines that we're in for this trip are that. Both of them have slightly bigger tires.
Mm-hmm.
Yours has sliders and a winch, but nothing...
It's going to affect performance.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly. Nothing super dramatic. And then this 100 Series Land Cruiser is just on a slightly bigger tire. It's a Yokohama Geolander. And other than that, it's bone stock. We didn't even pull the side steps off of it, which, you know, I mean, I think it would have been a benefit to have done that because we'd have a little extra breakover angle. I've only touched them down to the ground maybe 2 times, though,
yeah.
So far in all of our running. We haven't been doing Pritchard Canyon and the craziest stuff.
No.
Because you have to keep in mind the kinds of vehicles that we're in. It's not those. We're not in rock buggies. But all things considered, even in bone stock rigs like this, there's a lot of really good trails that you could go hit. Fins and Things being one of them. That's one of the reasons that we've run that trail so often.
Yeah, I mean, and like the goal with this, and I think kind of the goal with the channel in general, is we want to be able to do stuff that is fun, that pushes your skills a little bit, but doesn't get you in harm's way in essentially a stock vehicle, right? And there's a lot of channels that do some incredible builds and they do some amazing stuff with them. But I think like what really resonates with our audience is like you take a stock vehicle and you kind of go on an adventure with that, right? And that's basically what we're doing here.
Yeah.
And the other emphasis I want to do here, right, is like, you know, we don't have a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 rig. A lot of the vehicles we've seen out here are these full-size trucks with campers, right? And a lot of times you're going to be looking into 6 figures on those. But the advantage of what we've done, we're car camping, and we've got vehicles that are affordable, is like, you're willing to take them into places you might not. So we were at this campsite. We went down this gnarly little trail that was just tree after tree, pinstriping the crud out of them. But it's not really a huge deal.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, in this Land Rover's case, let's call it $7,000-$8,000 in that 100 Series, 15, right? So like, it's not the end of the world. Whereas if we had our $70,000 new Land Cruiser, we would never have tackled that, right? I would have turned around.
For sure. Yeah. So there's a lot to be said for a vehicle that's reasonably affordable and that you don't mind putting a little bit into harm's way, nothing too dramatic.
Yeah.
The other thing that I like is that you certainly could describe what we're doing with this trip as overlanding.
Sure.
Because we are staying in the vehicle.
Adventure travel, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
But these are both, as configured, pretty stealthy setups. So we don't have tons of things bolted to the outside, which keeps them, relative to the types of vehicles they are, relatively lightweight. As far as my camping setup, I have the memory foam mattress that I put in the back of my truck whenever I'm camping in it. My truck has an 8-foot bed, and so I've spent as much as 9 days, not an insanely long time, but a decent little stretch living out of it. And so I took the memory foam mattress that I usually put in the bed of the truck. I pulled the seats out of the Land Cruiser, so I get to stay in this vehicle. One thing that I like about this versus having a tent on the ground, especially, but even arguably compared to a rooftop tent, is that we are in bear country out here. So hard-sided camping setups is something that I'm personally fond of just for that reason. Plus, if nothing else, we also get some crazy winds, some crazy weather out here. And if the wind is absolutely whipping across your campsite, this is going to be a little more insulated and a little more comfortable by my calculation.
If you're wondering what that weird panting is, we got Blaze with us. Blaze is on this adventure with us. But yeah, I mean, you can see, like, we got some real mud caked up here on those side steps, and, you know, certainly the paint's a little bit worse for wear now, but I think a lot of that's going to come out, actually.
Yeah, definitely exactly the spot that we're in. Yeah. There was some pinstriping to get here.
So my camping setup's even more minimalist. I've just got like a pad and then a sleeping bag. And then I need a spot for Blaze if he's going to sleep next to me. But both these vehicles are big enough where you can realistically lay down inside of them.
Yeah, which is another nice thing about them, because they are on the larger side, on the heavier side. That Land Cruiser especially is closing in on 5,500 pounds.
I figured out my wheel wobble.
Oh, there you go.
Oh,
just
God.
Like in My Cousin Vinny, you got mud in there.
What the heck, dude? That is properly caked on there.
You've seen My Cousin Vinny, right?
I have not seen that.
Oh, that's a problem.
Is that a movie or is it a TV show?
Yeah, it's a movie. Joe Pesci and Marissa Tomei.
Please, stop eating poop. Please.
Yeah, this is an unusual podcast.
Yeah, this is crazy. So I'm going to have to figure out how to scrape that mud off before we get back on the road tomorrow. Yeah, it's been a pretty cool little adventure. And we're also out here during maybe not your typical week, because this is, I'm trying to remember what they call it. I think they call it the Toyota Summit Land Cruiser.
Cruise?
No. Oh, Cruise Moab.
Cruise Moab.
Good job, Case.
I am the one driving the Toyota. Oh, Blaze is knocking over our camera.
So Cruise Moab is essentially like the Easter Jeep Safari, but for Toyota people. So people come from all over the country to Moab and their various Toyotas. And we've seen some pretty crazy builds.
Yeah, earlier today we saw a 100 series on 40s, solid axle swapped, and a lot of trimming done, which was really cool. The guy was very kind because we were very obviously staring. Uh-huh. As he was pulling up, and he saw us staring, and so we acknowledged it by saying, we really like your Land Cruiser. And he said, oh, I like yours too. That's generous. This is basically full grandpa spec, you know, triple gray.
Yeah.
Nothing much going on.
It's not really on the same level.
No, it's not quite a solid axle swapped Land Cruiser on 40s. But I've got to say, as time has gone on and the more I've driven this, the more I appreciate just why everybody loves these machines so much.
Huh.
And it's not because this 100 series Land Cruiser with all its size and weight and everything, not because this is necessarily the most athletic, most capable rock crawling rig that you're going to take the hardest possible line on, but even in essentially stock form,
yeah,
it is a truly go anywhere SUV.
Yeah,
because we've gone to, again, not the craziest trails in Moab, but we've done some intentionally difficult things in both of these machines, and this really does a lot without breaking a sweat, even though it's completely unmodified. So if you want a machine that will just deliver you to any place you want to go, this is that.
Yeah, I've actually been pretty blown away with it. I mean, it looks visually, because the tire is kind of bigger than stock, these Yokohamas fill out the fenders, it looks very low. But there was some stuff like that I was surprised it cleared, right?
Yeah.
Even though it's a Land Cruiser, like we were at, there's this one obstacle today where there was this large boulder that was embedded in the earth. and there's really no way around it. And then it was super muddy leading up to it, so there was no graceful way of doing it. So I took in the Rover what I thought would be the best line, and I ended up slamming my rock rail into the rock and like skidding my way up to the top. And I was like, well, this is going to be a problem for the Land Cruiser. And you just did like a slight line adjustment, kept the speed up, and it just like hopped over that rock.
Yeah, and I don't even think it tagged the stuff.
No, didn't touch anything.
Again, if you want to go hit a trail in such a way as to pick the hardest possible line and do the most intense rock crawling you can imagine, then a Land Cruiser like this, you could build it into that kind of machine, but in stock form, it's not really what it is. Mm-hmm. But this will absolutely go just about anywhere you want to go. So it's a really impressive piece of equipment.
Yeah.
And it's not hard to see why people like them so much. It's also so comfy.
It's like, it is a very couchy. Yeah,
it is.
It's very couchy. Now, I'll give you my three pros and cons on my LR3, and then you give me the Rover. I think
Cruiser.
I got Land Rovers on the head. Number one pro of the Land Rover, and I keep saying this, but it's like the versatility, right?
Sure.
This is a vehicle that you can very comfortably carry seven people in. And then with the couple of twiddling of knobs, you can raise the suspension, put it low range, select rock mode, and then happily go do fins and things, or even Hell's Revenge I've done in this, and it's no problem, right? So I think that's very cool. Number two pro is the space. It's just like, it's unashamedly just a box.
Yeah.
Right? They just were like, let's just build a square. And that's what they did. And then number three, what was the third thing I really liked about it? Oh, just the level of comfort. I mean, that you've got that command seating position. You sit higher than any other vehicle on the road. You know, it's crazy. Like, it doesn't look that high, but you park next to, like, a new F-150, even a Raptor, and you're kind of right at that level. Yeah, and you get these huge windows, so you get a great view of the world. So those are my three pros. What about you? If I had to list three on the Cruiser.
Yeah, so three pros. After spending more and more time with the 100 series Land Cruiser, number one pro is the obvious one that is the broken record. Everybody talks about it. So reliability, obviously, these can do many, many hundreds of thousands of miles. 2UZ, that V8, incredibly smooth and incredibly long-lived. That is a million-mile engine if you keep up with the couple little bits of maintenance that you got to keep up with. So 100% dependability is a huge factor with this machine. Mm-hmm. So that's right up there. Likewise, with the LR3, comfort is also a really big deal on this. Toyota has had decades of experience making suspension systems that are just fantastic. Ride really smooth, handle really well on-road and off-road, all things considered. Obviously, it's not a 911, but the suspension on this is fantastic. Leather seats, very comfortable. It's very quiet. It's very smooth. So it's just a great machine to spend a lot of time in.
Yeah.
And then the community and parts availability around these also pretty great. So if you want to build this up into something bigger and more grandiose, and if you have the money to do it, then you absolutely can. So you can basically turn this 100 series into just about anything you want. But even in stock form, like we've been saying, there's a lot you can do with it. I am as much on board with modifying and personalizing vehicles as anybody out there. It's something that I do. But I'm also of the mind that you don't have to with this machine. You could leave it bone stock and do a lot of things with it, and you're not going to get left behind.
Okay, let's talk about cons. So with the LR3, I mean, the first thing we need to talk about is, like, the fuel economy is properly bad, right? So there were two engine options in the U.S. In Europe, there were a bunch of diesels. But here in the U.S., we got the 4.4 V8. It's called the AJ V8. They use it in everything at that time. So it was, like, in the Jaguar XK, right? It made its way in the Aston.
Ford Thunderbird
for some reason. Lincoln LS using AJ V8. And really, they built that engine from, like, 2000 and I think it's, like, 02. Through like today.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the supercharged V8 in the Defender is still an AJ V8.
AJ platform. Yeah. Obviously, it's been changed a lot over the years.
So genuinely, no one's going to agree with this, but I've seen and I've talked to people with 250, 300,000 miles on an AJ V8. Like, they are really long-lived engines. If you get a 4.4. The 5 liters had some more issues. They had timing chains. They had gasket stuff. But the 4.4 specifically very solid. Now, my stupid LR3 is a very rare model. It's a 4-liter V6 from the Ford Ranger. It's the power of a 4-cylinder and the fuel economy of like a V10. I mean, it's 217 horsepower, and I'm averaging like 14.6.
Yeah, to be fair, it's not very efficient, but at least it's slow.
At least it's slow. That's right. Yeah. So I wouldn't get the 4-liter if you're going to get the LR3, but even if you get the V8, especially if you get the V8, like 13, 14 is kind of the standard, and it's not like it's that fast. So it's just early 2000s fuel economy. Second thing I don't like about it, I mean, it's not like a thing I hate, but like if you're on a twisty back road, it handles like a barge, right? So like modern air suspension, there's almost always a sport mode to really stiffen things up.
Yeah.
This thing is, regardless of what ride height setting, it's always like Cadillac floaty, 70s floaty. So huge amounts of body roll. I love it because that's how I drive every day, is just like being floated around. I think it's fine. By the way, everyone's saying that air suspension is unreliable. We're out here in the middle of Utah. I just looked, and these airbags are date coded 2005.
So they're original.
They're original to
original
the car.
To the vehicle. It's a fair assumption because there are Land Rover products,
right,
like a P38 Range Rover, that have terrible air suspension.
Yeah.
But the LR3 and LR4 and the Range Rover Sport, the L320 first generation.
Yeah, really good.
Range Rover Sport. That air suspension system is actually really good.
And my final thing I don't like about it, so the four-wheel drive system is incredible, and people do turn them into rock crawlers, but it's very difficult to do so, and they're not really happy doing it, right? Like, there are things you can do to lift them. Like, I have a slight, quote, software lift, or basically I program the computer to sit, like, a centimeter higher. And you can get, like, an inch out of it, maybe an inch and a half, but then you start running into geometry issues. And then the aftermarket community is not tiny, but stuff is very expensive, especially on a car that's not worth much, right? So at least with a 100 series cruiser, you put money into it and it's still a valuable vehicle, but the part price is not much cheaper on the LR3. Like an ARB is going to be $1,800, $2,500.
And just because you spent 30 grand modifying,
you're never going to get it out of it, right? So the part and the aftermarket community is much smaller.
Yeah. Now people are obviously going to be very surprised that you haven't mentioned reliability as a con of the Land Rover.
Yeah.
Now, we've actually owned three of these LR3s now. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that this one in particular is solid and it's kind of an outlier. We've had a few of these LR3s, and all things considered, for a 20-year-old car and a car that you could get for this one less than $5,000, but consistently $6,000, $7,000, something like that. Pretty decent.
I was hoping during COVID, because like prices started coming back up, and then they just fell through the floor. So like, this is still a $4,000 car.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about what you mean by decent, right? So like, genuinely, specifically 06 through 09, like if you look at the common issues, so if you look at like the older Land Rovers, like your Discovery 2, right?
Yeah.
There are fundamental design flaws that make them horrible to own long term, unless you're weird and crazy like we are, right? But like head gaskets failure, liners slip, drive shafts explode that then takes out the transmission, the cooling systems were garbage. I mean, there were really big issues with them.
100%. And obviously there's been many Land Rover models over the years that had issues like that, and they've given them this reputation. The thing is that I think a lot of people don't care to investigate to a point where they have kind of a nuanced understanding of it.
Yeah.
Because
I agree.
I think it is still absolutely fair to say that the majority of Land Rovers are not the most reliable vehicles on the road.
Sure.
I think that's a reasonable thing to say. But the LR3, like you said, 06 to 09, it's a good motor. It's a good air suspension. The electronics aren't problematic. Cooling systems aren't problematic.
Yeah. I mean, there are like known issues. Like sometimes the gauge cluster, the pins that connect it to the wiring harness, right? Those can corrode and then you get weird faults.
I think they can still have sunroof leaks, right?
Sunroof leaks. Yeah, for sure. People do. And I'm kind of the outlier with the air suspension. People do replace air suspension, but it's not actually that expensive.
Yeah. And, you know, like any vehicle, there are some issues with some of them that need to be fixed here and there. I mean, ultimately, I don't tell anyone I said this, but second gen Tacomas used to split in half because the frames were rusting so bad. That's right. Also kind of a problem, right? But we still like Tacomas.
I mean, and then you end up with this discussion about like age in any vehicle.
Yeah.
Right? Both of these are 20, 21 years old now.
I mean, we had the front diff explode on this. It's got 240,000 miles. It's 20 years old.
I mean, things just wear out, right? Like control arms wear out, bushings wear out, brakes wear out.
Also, for the people that aren't watching videos, when I say front diff explode, I'm pointing at the Toyota, Land Cruiser.
Believe it or not. Yeah, right. And I think like if you want a vehicle and you never want to do maintenance, yeah, I think the Land Cruiser will probably take you further.
Oh,
and then spit out a massive repair bill. Right, and that happens a lot on 100 series. People buy them for what they think is cheap, and then like we did, you end up spending $4,000 on it immediately. Right, Land Rover's just going to kind of nickel and dime you a little bit more, but ultimately, like I do genuinely think you can have an experience in a Land Rover that's not as terrible as
the internet would have you believe.
Yeah.
Now, off of our soapbox, because ultimately, there's plenty of people out there that no matter how many of these things that we buy and take on a trails and own for years and put real miles on and actually buy with our own money,
right?
There's still 99% of the reasonable people out there in the world that are never going to buy it. That's fine.
Sure.
It keeps the prices low.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Three cons with the 100 series.
Three cons with the 100 series. Now, despite what some of the fangirls might say, there are actually some drawbacks.
Are there?
To this
really?
Vehicle. There actually are. For me, I think the number one thing is the weight of it. Look, it's a large vehicle. That doesn't mean you can't go run difficult trails. Doesn't mean you can't kit these things out to be super capable. It is just a factor. It's this one, as it sits right now, is almost 5,500 pounds, not including the gear that's in it. And you feel that when you're driving it. So there are 4x4s out there that are narrower, lighter, feel a little bit more athletic on the extreme end of the spectrum.
Yes. Not a lot of athleticism in 100 series. Yeah, I'll give you that.
In some ways.
For sure.
Yeah. That, I would say another big one being cost. Because these vehicles are so sought after and because they are so long-lived, they really do hold value really well. Which if you own one already and you're going to sell it, then that's
great
a good
news.
Thing. Yeah, that is good news because you'll get good money for it. But it's not uncommon to look around online and see a 100 series Land Cruiser with 300,000 miles and a wee bit of rust that's listed for $12,000-$15,000, and the seller sees it as, look, I'm doing you a favor here. By even letting you buy this car.
Yes.
So trying to find an affordable one
and they
can be a pain.
These don't seem to rust, LR3s, but 100 series do rust. Like, it's very common to see rusty 100 series. Especially around windshields.
Sure.
Like, underneath, I've seen some really rusty 100 series.
Yeah, LR3, there's a lot of aluminum.
Yeah, and it's...
That helps.
Yeah, it's a little bit more modern. I mean, this is still fundamentally a 90s design, where this is a 2000s design.
Yeah.
But, sure.
Yeah, and then the number three con for me is the front diff on this. So independent front suspension is not inherently problematic, even though some people kind of feel like it is. There's plenty of very durable and very capable independent front suspensions. Just look at the Bronco, for example.
For sure.
It's really good setup, articulates very well, durable, even comes from the factory on a Raptor, Bronco Raptor with 37s.
Yeah, it's cool.
So that's an impressive system. This one in particular, it's not a massive front diff. And there are 2-pinion and 4-pinion front diffs for these 100 series Land Cruisers. Some people say that the 4-pinion is stronger. It doesn't sound like it's necessarily guaranteed to be significantly stronger. And it is kind of the Achilles heel on these.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
You can definitely get into a situation where you break that front diff, especially if you're wheeling it hard. And especially if you go to a bigger tire. Because it's a heavy vehicle, that's just kind of a part of it. There's still, again, there's so much you can do with this machine without that front diff being an issue. But it's still, as I drive it and it gets articulated and starts to struggle a little bit, it's something that's in the back of my mind.
I think, if I remember right, I think early hundreds were eight-inch front pinions, and I think maybe they went to an 8.5, but if I recall, like, that's the essentially the same front diff out of the 80 series.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that was a fairly anemic inline six, and it was fundamentally like a lighter weight vehicle. And I mean, not to start pulling trump cards, but if you compare it to like the Land Rovers of the same era, they were running 9.5-inch diffs, right? And you never hear about those failing. So I think that they did undersize them. Now, granted, when I blew this up, I was doing something pretty stupid. But it always is at the end of the back of your mind. And like, we read those comments too, but people are like, yeah, 100 series are perfect. I have had to replace four front diffs, but they are perfect. So that, I mean, yeah. I think that is a real problem.
And yeah, I mean, it was kind of an extreme use case when the front diff let go on this one for us, but you're not the first person to have a front diff let go on a 100 series.
Probably not.
It happens.
Yeah, it does.
It's a known thing. It's mm-hmm. not just us. You can read about it.
On the interwebs.
On the interwebs. Even the internet admits
it is that a problem.
They can break. So, yeah, ultimately, this is a really fantastic vehicle. I don't want anyone to leave this podcast saying that we think the LR3 is necessarily
no, for sure.
a better vehicle than 100 series Land Cruiser,
yeah.
because somebody will throw a brick through the window of our office.
That's right. That's a bad day.
And that costs a lot more money than what YouTube videos make.
So I do want to talk a little bit about some of the interesting trends we've been noticing out here in Utah. So obviously Cruise Moab's going on. My dad went last year, and I think I want to go back next year because I think there's some interesting things happening. Now we've seen some of the rigs that you'd expect, right? So like at the Sand Flats Recreation Area, we saw like the big tired early 4Runner stuff, right? Like 84, 85, the trucks, solid axle with big tires. That, you've always seen that. Seen some pretty crazy 80 series out here, and then that really built 100. But I'm starting to see a lot, and I do mean a lot, of the new gen stuff, right? I mean, today on the trail we saw, they were a little bit in front of us, but there was like a group of new 4th gen Tacomas and the new 250 series Land Cruiser. We saw that 4Runner.
6th gen 4Runner.
Yeah, with the big 35s. That looked really good. So, like, I think the community is really starting to embrace the new turbo / hybrid stuff.
Yeah, there's definitely plenty of people that are uninterested in the complexity of those powertrains, but the sales numbers say a lot. And those vehicles, they're moving units.
Big units, yeah.
People are buying them. And, God, we're going to upset all of the old school Toyota body on frame people here. But the new gen stuff, turbo four cylinders, especially here at high altitudes with steep grades, they drive much better.
Yes.
The new 4Runner with a four cylinder drives better.
Yeah.
Than the fifth gen.
Oh, for sure. There's no comparison.
Hands down.
Well, and you know, like, there's been a lot of talk about problems. And like, one of the most common issues we're seeing, especially with Tacomas, and I've talked to some people who are very in the know about this, put it to you that way, like failing transmissions / hybrid components. So be that like the integrated motor in the transmission, which requires a some $20,000 transmission replacement, right? Be it other hybrid components. And there does seem to be one trend, and I'm not going to say it's user error because Toyota should address it, but like, I think what's happening, and if, like I said, from talking to people in the know, a lot of these failures are related to people off-roading, quote, incorrectly. And what I mean by that, like, is if you look at the horsepower and torque numbers on 4Runner and Tacoma hybrid, I think that torque number is 465 pound-feet, right? So huge amounts of torque, and they're so much faster than the old stuff that people are now hitting the trails and not sticking the trucks in 4Low. So basically what they're doing is they're using that immense torque to muscle the truck up obstacles, even somewhat light obstacles, right? And they're not getting that mechanical advantage of gearing down in 4Low.
Yeah.
And what that's doing is, yes, the powertrain can do it, but you are ultimately going to build up a huge amount of heat, right? And I think that from some folks I've talked to, that heat buildup and that strain you're putting on the transmission and hybrid system is what's causing these failures. Now, what's interesting, and I'm surprised that Toyota doesn't do this, and I'm pretty sure they don't do it,
first things first, if you're on a trail, just go right into 4-low. Like, even if it's a 3 out of 10, right?
Yeah.
Just stick it in 4-low. You get more control and you build up a lot less heat. You're wearing out your components a lot slower. But what, like, Land Rover does, oh, God, people are going to hate me for this. But if you're going up a trail in a Land Rover, right, especially the newer stuff, and you start getting on the throttle, they're also very powerful. They will muscle through it, but the computer will throw a ding, and it will say 4-low recommended, right?
Yeah.
Because it can look at how much throttle you're giving it, how much torque is being applied, and realize this person's probably off-road. It needs to be in low range.
So you're suggesting more chimes, Tommy.
I agree that the Toyota stuff chimes too much, but I think that there's fundamentally, people are just going to keep doing it.
You know what chimes incessantly?
What?
Fords.
They do chime incessantly.
You put it into low range and whatever off-road mode you want to be in,
yeah,
and it's telling you adaptive cruise, unavailable.
Right.
And all these things. It's like, yeah, that's fine.
I know.
And sometimes it will warn you of that every minute, and it's doesn't crazy. Seem to go away.
So, getting off my soapbox here, I think that there needs to be a chime or at least a message saying 4-low recommended, and then just more consumer understanding that, like, yes, you can do it in high range, but just don't put the strain on and go to low, right? And, like, we were talking about this earlier. If James, my buddy James, if you're listening to this, our 4Runner buddy, who's in Moab right now at Cruise Moab, he's got a really nicely built out 5th-gen 4Runner. The reality is, you can't run that thing in 4 high. Because it's too bloody slow, right? Like, you'd be foot to the floor just trying to get up mild obstacles.
You got British for a second there.
I did. But the new stuff, you can just power up. So, like, the old stuff, you had to go in low range or it practically wouldn't move.
Yeah.
A little bit of an exaggeration, but not really. Like, they're slow vehicles.
On a steep enough hill and a 4Runner that's got enough stuff weighing it down.
Yeah. It will feel
high
like
range,
it's working.
First gear.
Yeah. It will let you know I'm working really hard.
Yeah.
And the new stuff just won't.
Yeah.
So,
sure.
But, like, do you think long term, this is a loaded question, but do you think the new stuff could be as reliable as the older stuff? Here goes the keyboard commandos.
As reliable? Probably not in the long run, right? Maybe not 300,000-400,000 miles or so with as few issues because it is, the older stuff is simpler. But at the same time, I mean, if you're buying, for example, a 5th-gen 4Runner because it can get to 400,000 miles with, you know, relatively minor repairs, and you sell it, you buy that thing brand new, and you sell it at 70,000 miles, you're saving the major benefit of it for the next person.
Mm.
Or maybe the person after them.
That's
or the
true.
Person after them.
Yeah, yeah.
So, if you're buying something brand new, I think most people buying brand new cars aren't bringing them to 200,000-400,000 miles. So, you know, for the 200,000-250,000 miles, I think it's going to be 90% as good. It's hard to put a number on it.
I mean, it's tough. Like, reality is, if you look at the data, and I don't want to misquote it, but a little while back, it's something like the average new car is, so the average car on the road is like 12 years old, and the average person keeps a new car like 9 or 10 years, right? So that's roughly 100, 120,000 miles is what the typical new car buyer keeps, right? So you're buying reliability for the third owner.
Yeah.
In some ways, right?
Yeah.
And ultimately, like, as warranties continue to get longer, right? I mean, is it really going to be a problem if you're only going to keep the car 60,000 miles, which isn't unheard of?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, everybody says, I'm going to buy this car and keep it forever. But nobody does. Like, people get bored of cars, you know? That's just the reality of life, right? We want to experience different things and experience change, and be it new cars or used cars. Like, people just don't typically, unless you're in the Van Ries family, keep a car for 25 years.
That's my family, by the way.
Yeah, that's Case's family.
We do hold on to cars for a while.
Right. And I don't say you have to be in the Micah family where you go through cars every 28 minutes, but there's, like, the reality is most people are, like, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years is average.
For sure. And I think there's plenty of precedent for a hybrid Toyota to go plenty far.
Sure.
And not need major maintenance. How long have they been making the Prius for?
Well, yeah, that's
and
true.
how reliable is the Prius?
Right.
Not that necessarily 4Runner and Land Cruiser people want to be compared to a Prius.
Right.
But they are good cars in that sense. They go a really long distance.
They do go a long distance. Let me make sure this camera's still rolling.
Oh, yeah, that would be bad.
Our toolbox is currently filming us. Yes, they do go a long distance. And then what about, like, people love to say that turbos are unreliable. And it's a little bit of apples to oranges, but, like, I mean, obviously diesels have been turbocharged for 50 years now, right? And in the heavy-duty applications, they're looking at million miles. But even in the light-duty stuff, like, if you look at your Cummins, like, 400,000, 500,000 miles is not uncommon. Now, granted, yeah, gas engines are a different can of worms, but, like, turbos have been around for long enough where I think we know how to do them and for make sure them last, especially a brand like Toyota.
Yeah, and Toyota's been doing hybrid systems for a long time, so do I think it's going to be as reliable as some of their older products after 400 or 500,000 miles? No, but they also drive a lot better.
Even though in some ways the characters of the engine are worse.
Sure, they don't sound good.
They don't sound good, and they're a little buzzy.
But they have low-end torque, and for me, in a truck or an SUV, mm-hmm, low-end torque is pretty important.
Like,
it adds a lot to the drivability, sure, of them and the experience of driving them. So I think it's an overall improved experience to actually drive those vehicles.
Please.
So you just have to figure out,
hey,
what is the right combination of things for you? I mean, if all out reliability is literally the only thing that matters to you,
uh-huh,
full stop, then maybe not the new product. But if you care about a combination of,
oh my God. Hey, sorry, the dog keeps eating the cow patties on the ground. No, keep going. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, if you care about a combination of drivability and a vehicle that's more modern, more recently updated, because some of the older Toyota product that was going away, look, a third-gen Tacoma didn't drive that great. That six-speed and V6 combo would hunt for gears all the time.
Well, and
fantastic.
The problem is people are like, I don't like the character of the new turbo form. Like, well, yeah, but you're comparing it against a 3.5 V6 that was always at 100 million RPM, right? And it was not like a great sound. I mean, the sound of a naturally aspirated V6 is not, it's not like the baritone of a V8. So, like, what you're comparing it against is fundamentally not that characterful of an engine.
Yeah, it's right? Two different brands of vacuum cleaner.
Yeah. Couple other things I want to talk about before we close up here. Xterra is coming back.
Yeah, which is a big deal. There's some teaser images out there which don't reveal a ton other than the fact that it seems like the new Xterra is going to look obviously very modern. Not necessarily, it doesn't seem like it's going to be super retro, but they were showing off some amber lights and things.
Yeah.
It looks interesting.
And so I don't think I can say much about it, but I will say this. My dad was in Japan with Nissan this past week.
Yeah.
And they actually took them behind the scenes, took their cameras, and then showed them the new Xterra. And he said it looked pretty legit.
But so, even for the regular public, there are teaser images where you can start to get a little bit of a feel for what they're shooting for. So I think it's going to be really interesting. Obviously, they see the value in that market because it's a huge market. It really blew up almost immediately after they stopped making the Xterra.
Like 2014.
And there are obviously there's many considerations for making a vehicle like that, right? There's CAFE regulations were a factor, especially in the past.
Yeah.
That are relaxing now that are making it easier, according to Nissan, for them to actually make a vehicle like that. So it's something that we're very much looking forward to. And I know there's been a lot of talk, a lot of buzz and rumor around 35s.
Yeah, so like, what do you think Nissan needs to do for that thing to be a big hit?
It's a good question. I mean, for sure, it's got to have a lot of baked-in capability, right? It can't just look rugged. And I don't think that that's going to be the way it goes. They knew what made the Xterra work more or less in the past and what makes people love that vehicle even to this day. So you got to shoot for a baseline level of some real capability based on the hardware that it's running.
I mean, it can't be a Rogue on tires, basically.
It can't be a Pathfinder Rock Creek.
Yes, it has to be legit.
Yeah, it's got to be legit. And I think that they've got some of the hardware to make that happen because they have the Frontier. I think they're going to do more, if I had to guess, than just slap a SUV body on a Frontier. But as far as I see it, I think you could theoretically reuse a lot of that to make a rugged SUV and make people pretty happy.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, I think that...
But we don't know yet, actually, what they're going to do.
We don't, but I think... They've confirmed it's body on frame.
Yeah.
It's already a good start, so it's not going to be a Pathfinder, right? Because that's unibody. Although, apparently, the new Pathfinder might be body on frame, too, is what I was reading.
Yeah,
which would be cool. But I think that they have to prioritize the actual effectiveness of the four-wheel drive system.
For sure.
And make it a legit machine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because that's going to be tested. Pathfinder is funny because I don't think there's another vehicle that's gone back and forth between body on frame and unibody construction like the Pathfinder has.
Yeah, because it started body on frame.
First gen, third gen.
Not fifth, though.
Not fifth, but first gen and third gen are body on frame, if I remember right.
It was like BOF unibody, BOF unibody, unibody again in the current one.
And then maybe back to body on frame.
Body on frame, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, like, you lose a lot of potential cargo space with body on frame. Fuel economy is harder to achieve with body on frame. But I think, like, what Nissan's doing, I'm sure, is they're looking at the 200,000 Wranglers they sell every year, the 150,000 Broncos they sell every year, right? The, I don't know what it is, $200,000 Forerunners they sell every year. $200,000 would be an expensive Forerunner. We're getting there, though.
Now all we need is for GM to take notice.
Well, did you see that they confirmed that they're going to, I think they confirmed a body on frame Jimny.
Really?
Yeah.
So I had seen some rumors about that and people emailing us, but I hadn't seen official confirmation of it. Is it?
I don't. Maybe it's just rumor mill, but.
Could be rumor mill.
I mean, they kind of.
They kind of need to.
Kind of burn the Blazer name a little bit, because that's being used for something that's not a Blazer.
Jimny would be cool, though.
It's a good name. Yeah, they should bring that back.
It's close to your name, Timmy.
That's right. You got it, Case. That's right. But it's going to be really interesting, I think, next few years. I'm a little worried that Nissan's a little late to the game, right? And GM is going to be really late to the game, because, like, the height of what we're doing right now, in my opinion, was, like, 2021, 2022. And you can actually see that by going to someplace like the Overland Expo, right? When COVID hit, everybody wanted to come out here to the wilderness. So they all went out and they started buying like parts and accessories and lift kits like crazy. But now a lot of that kind of pipeline, has shrunken a lot. And you go to the Overland Expos now and like they're still fun and I recommend doing them, but they're so much smaller than they were a few years ago. Because people have to go back to work, right? Yeah. I do think people still want, there's fundamentally that American drive for an adventure vehicle. So we're always going to have needs for rugged four-wheel drives. But they're going to be a little bit of an uphill battle.
Yeah, it's still the general trend. Even if people aren't necessarily spending as much money on aftermarket parts and camper trailers and things like that, the trend is still always towards bigger vehicles, SUVs. And people love rugged SUVs for good reason.
They do.
Because it's confidence inspiring. They look good. They maybe ride a little softer. So I would be perfectly fine with it if the trend of sporty SUVs, where everything's got to be stiffer and it's got to handle well.
That were to die?
It doesn't have to die. But it can scoot over a little bit to allow for more rugged SUVs.
I like it. All right, guys. Well, there's our impromptu podcast. I hope that this worked. And we'll have this full video, our Onyx Off-Road Rugged Adventure, in the next couple weeks, likely. And drop us a comment what you guys think.
Absolutely. All right. See you next time.
We'll see you next time.